I'd like to welcome you to this session of the Sunstone Symposium. This is session number 93. Two papers will be presented in this session, one by Dr. Colleen McDaniel from the University of Utah, and one by Dr. David Knowlton from BYU. Mr. Eric Olson will provide a response to both papers. Dr. McDaniel and Dr. Knowlton will each have 30 minutes with 15 minutes for Mr. Olson, and we should have some time for questions and comments from the audience. As Mr. Olson has an engagement in Colville right after this, as soon as he can get there, I understand, we'll need to make sure that we end the session right on time. And I'd like to give you just a little bit of information about the speakers today before they speak. Dr. McDaniel serves as the Sterling McMurrin Chair in Religious Studies at the University of Utah and is also Associate Professor of History. She received her PhD in Religious Studies from Temple University in 1984. She's interested in researching and writing in the areas of American religions, gender and family studies, particularly Irish-American culture and history, and material culture studies. Recently, she's just spent 3 months in India, where she's been studying Christian cemeteries on a fellowship. She's been doing research in New York City on Irish Catholics, and she's recently published in the journal Religion an essay entitled Interpreting Things, Material Culture Studies, and American Religion. She also has a book, Heaven, A History, which is now appearing in Dutch and Italian translations. Colleen's paper is entitled Sacred, Secret, and the Non-Mormon. Dr. Knowlton is an assistant professor of anthropology at Brigham Young University. He received his bachelor's at the University of Utah, his master's and PhD from the University of Texas at Austin. Dr. Knowlton is a lecturer on a variety of topics very suitable to LDS audiences, including the Church Missionary Program and the phenomenon of LDS testimony bearing. He's an author of a recent Sunstone article entitled Belief, Metaphor, and Rhetoric, The Practice of Testimony Bearing. The title of his paper today is Why Can't We Talk? Secrecy, Deceit, and the Sacred in Mormonism. Mr. Olson was born in Oakland, California, and was raised in Tempe, Arizona. He attended Brigham Young University as an undergraduate and received his bachelor's degree in English with a minor in history in 1977. He received his law degree from the University of Virginia at Charlottesville in 1980. He's practiced for 3 years in Louisville, Kentucky, and has practiced for the last 9 years with the law firm of Vancott, Bagley, Cornwall, and McCarthy in Salt Lake City, Utah. He served in LDS mission from 73 through 75 in Mexico. He is married, and he is the father of 6 children. Well, now I turn the time over to our presenters.
Hello. After last year's Sunstone Symposium, the Deseret News published a statement on the front page of its Metropolitan section. The statement was signed by the Council of the First Presidency and the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. The statement began, quote, "Recent symposia sponsored and attended by some members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints have included some presentations relating to the house of the Lord, the holy temples, that are offensive. We deplore the bad taste and insensitivity of these public discussions of things we hold sacred." End quote. While the statement never told members not to attend such symposia, the church leaders stated that, quote, "we are saddened at the participation of our own members." End quote. The Salt Lake Tribune elaborated on the Deseret News statement and cited my paper on temple garments as one of the problem presentations. While other paper presenters have had to justify their participation in the symposium to church leaders, I have received no follow-up telephone calls. Their comments, however, have motivated me to think seriously about the meaning of the sacred and how I, as a scholar of religion, should respond to such criticism of my work. Today, I'd like to address two questions. The first question is, how have religions understood the relationship between the sacred and the secret? From the perspective of the history of religion, how do Western traditions define the connection between that which we hold sacred, the phrase which was used in the statement, and that which we keep secret, its practical corollary? The second question I will raise has to do with my role as a non-Mormon doing research on a topic which some Latter-day Saints consider unresearchable. Is it ethically wrong for me to do historical research and to conduct interviews on the sensitive topic of garments? Are my studies, in the words of the church authorities, offensive, in bad taste, and insensitive? Let me start by admitting that I already presume a connection between the sacred and the secret by coupling the terms. Some LDS authorities would deny this connection. Nowhere in the Deseret News Statement or in other aspects of LDS culture are Mormons told that they should not talk about certain things because they are secret. Matters are not discussed because they are private, confidential, or sacred. However, most of us assume that when we are told not to discuss something, it means we're to keep it secret. While we may not understand exactly what the sacred is, we know from everyday life what secrets are. According to one definition, secrecy is the mandatory or voluntary, but calculated, concealment of information, activities, and relationships. We all keep and tell secrets. Institutions also keep and tell secrets. Mafia keep investigations secret. Corporations keep their businesses secret. Police keep investigations secret, corporations guard their business secrets, the mafia arranges murders in secret, and the FBI and CIA protect our national security in secret. Why do individuals and institutions keep secrets? Sociologists have given us many explanations. Secrecy helps preserve cultures from outside change and influence by slowing down innovation and providing social stability. Having secrets, or what some call exclusive knowledge, enhances individual and communal prestige. Secret organizations can pursue political rebellions or other goals hostile to the larger community. Internal discipline is easier maintained when secrets are involved and economic control more directly expressed. Most of us have mixed feelings about secrets. We relish our domestic privacy, but therapists tell us that too many secrets aren't good for us. We realize that at times the government keeps secrets, but we also demand the right to know. Scholarly literature available on secrecy is almost entirely written by sociologists and anthropologists, concerned with how people construct and maintain their societies. As a historian of religion, however, I see that limiting access to knowledge, rituals, and objects is a part of many religious traditions. I am reluctant to reduce religion to merely one of many social functions and to see secrecy as being a means to achieve specific social goals. What I think is more useful is to try to understand the nature of secrecy within religion. What is the relationship between the sacred and the secret? If we look at the Latin origin of the word sacred, we find that sacrum means what belonged to the gods or was in their power. Given the Roman religious tradition out of which the term developed, I immediately think of the cultic activities in Roman temples. Roman religion was primarily a religion of doing rather than believing. Sacrifices of animals were offered to gods by priests and priestesses in temples. The average citizen was excluded from the area of sacrifice. Consequently, the word sanctum, as in the English sanctuary, meant something which was walled off or otherwise set apart. Here we find a close connection between the sacred and the secret. Originally, the word sacred referred not to a place, not to a feeling. The temple area was sacrum and set apart for the gods. The area in front of the temple precinct, where the people gathered, was profanum, or in English, profane. Although there were mystery religions in ancient Rome with limited membership and which boasted exclusive knowledge, the term sacred comes not from this tradition, but from the public Roman cult. If we want to do linguistic justice to the origin of the word sacred, we might want to think of contrasting it with exclusive rather than secret. The Greek terms eros and agnos, from which our English word holy eventually derives, do not have the connotation of separateness or set apart, as sanctum does. It is from the Greek that the word holy comes to assume its meaning of purity, awe, and veneration. Like the classical Greeks and Romans, the ancient Israelites also had a term for sacred. Kadosh, from the root kud, means in Hebrew to set apart. Like most ancient religions, Israelite religion included oracles and animal sacrifices. Certain men who descended from certain families were permitted to assist in the sacrifices. As we can read in the biblical books of Exodus and Leviticus, great care was taken to define what was pure and sacred versus what was impure and profane. Likewise, the same notion of separation can be seen in Islam. The Arabic word harim means circumscribed, inviolable. The Kaaba, the Islamic sanctuary in Mecca off limits to all but Muslims, is called Abayat al-Haram, the forbidden house. The women's quarters in traditional Muslim home, where only the family is permitted, is called harim. Our English word harem mistakenly refers to the women rather than to the space set apart. The early Christians internalized the meaning of the Jewish law and rejected the Roman concern for appeasing the gods through sacrifice. Some Romans, however, saw Christianity as a secret cult which ate its God in cannibalistic rituals and practiced sexual immorality. According to historian Wayne Meeks, Christianity at the time of Paul was more exclusive than the Roman mystery cults. Christians believed they imparted, in the words of 1 Corinthians 2, verse 6, a secret and hidden wisdom of God, which God decreed before the ages for our glorification. Around the year 200, Christians were described as a people sulking and shunning the light, silent in public, who despise the Roman temples as dead houses, reject the gods, and laugh at sacred things. Within early Christian ritual, those who had not yet been baptized were restricted to the first part of the service, consisting of singing psalms, reading scriptures, and prayers. Only the Christians in good standing could attend the sacred meal where the bread and wine were consumed. Gnostic Christianity, one of the versions of Christianity which flourished during the first 5 centuries after Jesus' death, preached exclusivity in ritual and community life. It also claimed that its teachers possessed the secret teachings of Jesus. Valentinus, for example, taught a non-canonical set of gospels in private to certain people who had proven themselves spiritually mature. Orthodox Christian leaders accused the Gnostics of fraud and destroyed their gospels and writings. Mystical forms of religions, such as Gnostic Christianity, Sufi Islam, and the Jewish Kabbalah, emphasized that knowledge of the divine requires considerable study and meditation, and that only the most dedicated will ever be able to understand the inner religious truth. These esoteric traditions, however, never became influential because they resisted institutionalization and historically have been perceived as a threat to the main current of religious belief. After Christianity became the state religion of the once flourishing Roman Empire, boundaries between the sacred and the profane continued. The evolution of a clerical class, the development of the cult of saints and relics, and the construction of elaborate places of worship heightened the sense that certain locations and things were sacred. Access to the sacred continued to be restricted. Relics were hidden within golden containers. Only the priests could drink the sacred blood of Christ. Only males could enter into the church sanctuary. Only those versed in Latin and theology could read the Bible. With the Protestant Reformation came a change to the notion of sacred places and people. While Luther retained some Catholic notions of the sacred, the Reformed tradition of Calvin and Zwingli rejected the idea that particular places, things, or people were imbued with special godliness and thus should be set apart. The Puritans, for instance, refused to set aside special religious holidays and worked as hard on Christmas as any other day. They called their churches meeting houses in order to eliminate the idea that the space was holy. Puritans replaced the notion of an exclusive sacred space with the idea of an exclusive people. What was sacred was the community of the elect. The Puritan community, and not a place or thing, was set apart as holy. Those who led that sacred community assumed a powerful authority. However, Protestant theology denied the minister any magical powers because it asserted that all people had the ability and responsibility to address the divine. At the same time that Protestant theologians were reinterpreting the meaning of the sacred, innovations in technology made it more difficult to restrict knowledge to certain groups of people. The printing press began a trend which eventually would culminate in cheap, efficient communication and widespread literacy in Europe and North America. Contemporary Christianity has continued the Protestant trend of devaluing the set-apartness of the sacred. With the ordination of women to the Protestant clergy, the barrier restricting female access to the altar and pulpit has been dismantled. Although Catholics still have an all-male clergy, since the Second Vatican Council, Catholic liturgy has moved towards being, as one says in the computer biz, user-friendly. Masses are conducted in homes, guitars and folk singing lend an informal air to services, and lay people help the priest distribute communion. The Catholic priest still has exclusive power to change the bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ, but the laity is required to take on a more active role in church rituals. Although relics, rosaries, statues, and pious pictures are now enjoying somewhat of a comeback, most American Catholics understand the sacred in a way similar to Protestants. What can we conclude from this whirlwind and superficial tour of Western sensibilities toward the sacred and the secret? First, the Latin origin of the word sacred does not refer to special knowledge or pious feelings, but to a notion of a special space. While words obviously change from their original usage, there is a persistent strain in Western traditions to equate something sacred with a space which is set apart. Religions set apart their sacred space, their particular set of teachings or ethics, and even their community from the profane. Second, the sacredness of space or teaching or community excludes one set of people, but more importantly, it includes others. Concepts of the sacred do not exist in themselves, but are shaped and maintained by individuals. When rigid boundaries between the sacred and the profane are constructed, those people who are permitted in the realm of the sacred form a privileged class. The medieval priest, for instance, could touch the sacred host, but if anyone else touched the body of Christ, it was desecration. As a historian of religion, I must always ask, who is creating, through ritual, theology, revelation, the boundaries of the sacred? What types of power relations are established when access to the sacred is limited? Third, and most important for our discussion, is my conclusion that Western religions can more efficiently maintain limited access sacred space rather than limited access sacred knowledge. Spatial boundaries are easier to define and defend because they are physical. Knowledge is more difficult to control because it is immaterial. In Israelite religion, only the priest could approach the Holy of Holies. But through the biblical books of Exodus and Leviticus, all Jews learned of the ancient temple ceremonies. The Christian altar as a sacred space has existed since the first centuries. But Gnostic Christians could not maintain their communities based on secret knowledge against the attacks of an institutional, state-based church. With increases in literacy and the publication of scripture and theology in the vernacular, religious knowledge could not be confined to an elite group of educated Latin-reading men. Muslims who restrict non-Muslims from joining pilgrimage to Mecca delight in publishing picture books, travel journals, and theological treatises on the Hajj. They can restrict the space of Mecca to Muslims, but the nature and experience of pilgrimage is too essential to Islamic spirituality to demand silence. Even though a set-apart sacred space is easier to maintain than a set-apart community based on secret knowledge, restricting accesses to places, things, or information is common in Western religious traditions. If this is the case, shouldn't I accept the LDS church leader's criticism of my garment's presentation as being insensitive to LDS notions of the sacred? My response is no. In recent years, historians of religions have challenged the notion that words like the sacred or the holy exist as categories by themselves, untouched by politics in the general sense of the term. Jonathan Z. Smith, a colleague of the late Mircea Eliade at the University of Chicago, argues that the meaning of the sacred also must be negotiated between people. It does not fall untouched from heaven. Smith has written that we must recognize that most of our religious texts were produced by a well-organized, self-conscious, scribal elite who had vested interests in restricting and valuing certain places and things. This is not to deny or to affirm the claims of religious people that their revelations have divine and not human origins. What scholars are now asking are questions such as these. Once the revelation has been received, what happens to it? Who controls the access to information? Who interprets the information? Who preserves the information for future generations? And who is left out of the decision-making process? I use this line of thinking in my own research. The boundaries between the sacred and the profane are created and maintained by specific groups of people. For the authorities of the LDS Church, there is a rigid boundary between what goes on inside of the temple and what is on the outside. For them, not only should the space be exclusive, the information and the objects given within the space are reserved for the initiate. More importantly, however, they insist that even reflections or theologizing on the information is exclusive. For me to approach any aspect of the sacred, by entering the space or learning the information or reflecting on the meaning of the information is profaning the sacred. As a scholar of religion, these are precisely the dimensions of LDS culture I would want to study. If I was only interested in the institutional church, as described by church leaders, I would have to take this problem seriously. Church leaders will publicly only present limited amounts of information and theology for a scholar to work from. They will not, for instance, discuss how temple garments fit into their spiritual lives. Church leaders, however, are not the only ones who define the meaning of the sacred and set boundaries between the sacred and the profane. Church members have their own notions about what constitutes the sacred and what can and cannot be spoken to an outsider. I am more interested in what the average person thinks about the activities and because the activities and perspectives of the religious elite present only part of the story. From my experience, many Mormons accept the exclusive character of sacred space and sacred information, but they do not accept the notion that everything connected with the temple is reserved only for members in good standing. For some Latter-day Saints, reflecting on the meaning of their garments does not breach the boundaries between the sacred and the profane. These people define the sacred in a manner different from LDS authorities, and I must respect the boundaries they establish. Since church leaders will not publicly theologize about the garments, I studied the responses of those who will speak with me about this important aspect of their spiritual lives. Does this mean that I'm not accountable to anyone? Can scholars research and write whatever they want? In 1919, anthropologist Franz Boas wrote an indignant letter to a popular magazine objecting to the work of four anthropologists who helped gather intelligence during World War I. These scholars, Boas complained, quote, prostituted science by using it as a cover for their activities as spies, end quote. For Boas, scholars should not be collecting information for any purpose other than the betterment of human understanding. In the 1960s, anthropologists conducted field work in Latin America and Southeast Asia to help the American government plan counter various forms of counterinsurgency. Their research was cloaked in secrecy and was not accessible to other scholars or to the people they studied. The problem was not that anthropologists were telling the secrets of their informants, but that anthropologists themselves were being asked to keep secrets. Consequently, in 1971, the American Anthropological Association published a guide called The Principles of Professional Responsibility. It explained that an anthropologist's paramount responsibility is to those he or she studies. Where there is a conflict of interest, the welfare of the individuals with whom the researcher worked must be considered first. All clandestine research was condemned, and all scholarly results were asked to be made available to the public and, when possible, to the people studied. This code of ethics proposed by American anthropologists is applicable to my work as a historian of religion. A religious community, such as the Mormons, is made up of a variety of subcommunities. There is the First Presidency and the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, but there is also the Mormons Women's Forum. My responsibility is not to the church elite, who I did not interview, but to those who I did interview. The church leaders who published the statement could not make helpful criticism of my conclusions on garments, because they have decided that speaking about garments by definition profanes things which we hold sacred. They challenged my right to speak about garments, not the content of what I said about garments. Consequently, the criticism which is significant for me comes from people who will talk about garments, those people I interviewed and my own professional community. I rely on their evaluations to keep me from producing writing which they consider offensive, in bad taste, or insensitive. Thank you.
Colleen has spoken to us in the great tradition of the scholarly study of religion, and she's made a couple of distinctions that I think are very important. They're important in part because they run in an antithetical direction to that which most of us as Mormons would take. First of all, in her distinction of various communities among Mormons and the inherent ascription of legitimacy to each of those communities, be they Mormon Women's Forum or the General Authorities, the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, as equally legitimate forms of religion, we find an idea that, although prevalent in the scholarly community, would seem to run counter to a Mormon idea of the church being a body of the faith, with a consistent consensus about what it means to be Mormons, with a direction being set by a prophet from the top and then percolating down to the masses of the people. I bring this out because I think that the distinction is important. I think it's important to notice that oftentimes scholars will take a different direction in their study of a given community than the community might see itself. I, as an anthropologist, have a problem with this because I wear two hats. I'm an anthropologist who looks at Mormonism, meaning that when I look at Mormonism, I will look at Mormonism as a congeries, to use that horrible sociological word, of different communities, of different groups of people with multiple beliefs and multiple ways of carrying out their religious ideas. As a believing Latter-day Saint, I also have the vision of the church as depending on revelation, with a very strong notion of the sacred, of contact with God. And believe it or not, it's not easy to bring these into any sort of synthesis or consensus. I will plead to a certain amount of professional schizophrenia, I'm afraid. But I think this is important because it'll help us to understand what I need to do today. In recent postmodern anthropology, it's been pointed out that we as anthropologists are not omniscient speakers who can stand above the fold from a sort of divine perch and tell everything there is to know or be known about a given people. Instead, we've noticed that anthropologists are human beings, meaning that we interact with a community. We learn about the community from a given network of people. Our ideas, our observations, scientific though they may be, are always limited to our position in space, at least to a degree. This means that I, as an anthropologist who looks at Mormonism and also a native Mormon, and this leads to conflicts. Last September, as many of you know, I was called in by my stake president to respond to criticisms about my last Sunstone presentation last year on terrorism in the church in Latin America. As my stake president and I talked, he never explained to me what the criticism was. I still to this day do not know why there's been a problem about my talk. I do not know what in the content of the talk was offensive. I do not know what problems there were with the talk. All that I know is that my speaking about terrorism somehow triggered a discussion among the apostles, because my stake president told me so, that then triggered them to tell Elder Carmack to call my stake president, to call me in, and ask me about my Sunstone presentation. Well, obviously, I haven't responded appropriately to the criticism, because I've responded in some ways as an anthropologist, as an intellectual, demanding a rational explanation of why. What specifically was offensive? I gather from comments my stake president has made that the appropriate response would have been the submissive recognition that because authority had spoken, therefore I was in the wrong, and should seek in the privacy of my heart, through fasting and prayer if need be, to ask the Lord what I had done wrong and thereby amend my ways. There, in this kind of idea, the Lord becomes a mediator and a confirmer of both the position of the general authorities and of my position as a member of the church. I point this out because the two ideals have been in conflict. Not because I see them in conflict, but because I've run into kind of a wall between my professional life and my religious life. A very troublesome wall, as I'm sure many of you are aware. This leads me, however, to put on my other hat as an anthropologist and start analyzing. We anthropologists have a professional liability in that almost whenever we're with people, we start analyzing the social situation. So today I would like to ask and like to explore secrecy, as Colleen has said, the sacred, and also deceit in Mormon practice. I'm aware that in some ways this is a preliminary work. It's a series of ideas and notes rather than a finished final analysis. But all the better, it gives us grounds for discussion, I hope. Anthropology presents a viewpoint of the sacred much like Colleen has described to us, where the sacred is seen as something that either spatially or in terms of social practice is separated, marked off and distinguished from what we might call the profane, which would mean not vulgarity as we use it in English, the profane meaning everyday life. The sacred is simply something set apart. Now, to those of us who are believers, the sacred is something very different. The sacred has content. It has form. It has meaning. It has essence. When we pray and we receive an answer from the Lord, we know that we are receiving an answer from the Lord. I don't know about you, but when I go into sacred space like the temple, I often tingle with contact with the divine. But that's not the way the anthropologist looks at it. Because the anthropologist can't capture in their thought the metaphysical qualities of the sacred. As a believer, I can experience them. As an anthropologist who works oftentimes in Bolivia, I can get an idea by experiencing with the people their experience of the sacred. But I can't capture that metaphysical stuff in my theoretical language. Instead, I have to be able to relate the sacred to something else, to give it an explanation, to make it accessible to scientific understanding. By doing that, I automatically profane the sacred. But I cannot do a causal explanation. I cannot give form to it. I cannot give substance or meaning without somehow relating the sacred to the profane. The founder of anthropology and sociology, Emil Durkheim, one of the great founders, did an interesting thing that enabled the development of an anthropology and a sociology of religion in some ways. He turned religion on its head. Instead of asking, how does religion come from above, from the divine, and then organize society, he instead asked, how does society organize religion? There's a famous statement where he says God is merely the projection of society onto the heavens, where society needs an image of itself and so projects it onto the divine. Does this mean that there is no such thing as the divine? Of course not. It merely means that to give a scientific understanding of what God is or what the sacred is, we have to see how people take their ways of thinking, their ways of understanding, and attach it to whatever it is, I'm speaking as an anthropologist, that really lies out there. Whatever it is that makes my spine tingle when I go into the temple. Whatever it is that makes my heart glad when I receive an answer to a prayer. In other words, Durkheim encouraged us to look to see how we as human beings make God after our own image. When we feel the response of the divine, we understand it in our terms. And our terms are inherently related to other aspects of our society. I make this clarification because I want to speak somewhat as an anthropologist. When I profane the sacred, I also don't want you to think that I'm denying the act of the believer, or that I am denying God, or that I am denying spirituality, or denying faith. The anthropology is very satisfying to the mind, and even to the heart sometimes. But there's much that it can't satisfy. Anthropology can never hold a sunrise over a mountain peak. It can also never hold the subtle whisperings of the spirit to one's soul. But it can sure help me understand it in cognitive, intellectual ways. But there's a tension here, a necessary tension, I think, between intellect and spirit. Not to set them as dichotomous opposites, but merely to say there's a tension between intellect and spirit. Mary Douglas, another anthropologist, has done an interesting thing by locating the spirit in terms of the boundaries. Another anthropologist by the name of Roy Rappaport argued that per force, by necessity, the sacred has to be an empty category, an empty set. He said that there can really be no necessary content to the sacred. That society is instead bound off the sacred with taboos, with boundaries, with proscriptions and prohibitions, thereby giving it the appearance of substance, when in reality it's an empty space that governs society. Now, to the believer, this is a very offensive kind of category, because it's saying that there really is no God, perhaps. But this is from a material anthropologist who cannot grant the metaphysical priority, and instead has to ask about how God is created from social activities, from social motions. But I think there's something very interesting here. Mary Douglas did amazing work by focusing on the boundaries, on the taboos, and the way those boundaries reflect our basic social essence, our social reality, our society. When those boundaries are crossed, we experience danger, violation, even loss of self. Because the existence of the sacred is what guarantees our existence as human beings, as meaningful culture-bearing human beings. If we violate the boundaries, thereby it seems we have violated the sacred. Thereby it seems that we lose ourselves. Okay? These notions of taboo and mana actually come from Polynesia, from Polynesian society. And they're not unlike notions of secrecy. Taboo in Polynesia was referred to the situation and prestige of the elite, of given chiefs or leaders within society. Mana was the substance, the effective, meaningful power that they had. Okay? The anthropologist inverts that and says, sees taboo in the boundaries and mana as stemming from the boundaries as not being necessarily inherent. I apologize for this very abstract stuff here. It's kind of necessary to lay some groundwork. These concepts have provided for a powerful opening to help an anthropologist or a historian of religion or a sociologist understand religious belief of the sacred. Now, as a Mormon, I'd like to talk about the sacred in Mormonism. I don't want to profane it. I don't want to damage it. I don't want to remove it. I don't want to deny it. But I do want to understand how it works. I have a toolkit coming from anthropology and sociology of religion. But I need to understand how exactly we grasp this notion of the sacred. How do we conceive it? How do we give it meaning and effect and importance in our lives? How do we mobilize it? As Colleen rightly pointed out, there's been a movement in Christianity towards a dismissal of effective symbols or a dismissal of sacred space. Now, I would argue that in Mormon, well, maybe I better clarify what I mean by that. We have the temple, to be sure. But in contrast with Bolivia, where mountains are sacred, we don't have sacred mountains. We don't really focus on emblems or amulets. We may have garments, but we don't focus very much on icons or other sacred artifacts. Now, in most societies, these artifacts perform an important function. What do? They take that which is ineffable, namely the sacred, and they make it tangible and concrete. They perform an act we could call semiotic downward mobility, meaning they take what is really extremely abstract, or as Roy Rappaport said, relatively empty of content, and I remind you that to a believer, that's not the way it's experienced, but they take it and bring it down to a level where it has tangible, concrete correlates in everyday life. Now, I would argue that in our society, our Mormon society, because of the relative lack of signs, effective, meaningful icons that bring the sacred down, that mobilize it, so that we know that we're in contact with the sacred, we have to find other things to take its place. As an anthropologist, not as a believing Mormon, I have to say that a society needs some way of mobilizing this abstract, the sacred, making it meaningful, making it walk, talk, and reveal itself. How do we do it? Well, like much of Protestantism, we actually make language bear the burden of the sacred. If you think about Pentecostalism, you may be familiar with speaking in tongues, or as it's called technically, glossolalia. Speaking in tongues to the Pentecostal is a sign of the Spirit. It tells the person that they have been sanctified. It tells them that they have been lifted up, graced them with its presence. It's a sign, an effective, meaningful sign of the Spirit. How do we do that? Well, in part, we do it through language also. But we do it in a different way. In an earlier article, I mentioned about testimonies and the importance of what I would call sacred speech as mobilizing the person's contact with the Spirit, as giving it concrete, tangible reality. Here I'd like to extend that a little bit and say that we need to look thoroughly at Mormon speaking. Because I think the problem with the secret, the problem with what we're seeing in terms of the current controversies, involves in part our inherent understanding of the role of speech, its relationship to sanctification and salvation, its ability to mobilize the divine as a function, and for us as members, its dual role of helping us to reflect on our spirituality, our Mormonism. At the same time, it serves as a medium of communication among us. Now, earlier I talked about my stake presidents and my interaction. In this, I see a model of what good Mormon speech should be. Good Mormon speech should not be empty flattery, vain repetitions, evil speaking, empty words. Instead, it should be simple, pure words that respond to the soul, that are able to communicate almost with pure thought, pure affect, pure emotion, directly with God. Speech is something that's sealed by the Spirit, or should be sealed by the Spirit. The ideal of a testimony, and what makes a testimony so important among us, is that a testimony is a very individual experience of the same thing. So that each of us of Latter-day Saints, in our own little ways, have an individual experience with the divine, a little bit of gnosis, that really is indescribable, unmanifestable in words, other than in the formal ritual words that are given to us, and the kind of paralinguistic things like tone of voice, or pitch, timbre, so on, and as well as the ritual time and place of bearing testimony that give it meaning and importance. Okay. This notion is a dangerous notion because it implies a certain possibility for metaphysical anarchy. If you think about it, every individual having the possibility of getting access to the divine through testimony opens the door for every individual to have a different revelation, if I think as an anthropologist. Okay, everybody would have almost a separate individual revelation, which could lead to spinning out, scattering the faith. So instead I have to look for mechanisms that keep that from happening. Why don't we, as Latter-day Saints, each have a separate testimony? The Mormon answer is because we get it from God. Remember, the anthropologist says God is the projection of society. So as an anthropologist, I have to stand over here and say, how does the Mormon society provide for continuity, for similarity, for constancy in things like testimony? One answer to that is that testimony is inherently a group-based performance. Like most rituals, it anchors group process in individual thought and activities and emotion. Through things like testimony, we take our personal life, our individual situations, and locate them in terms of community reality. We take and understand our own selves through the words, the process, the images provided us by the code. One important fact about a testimony or about prayer is that they are extremely restricted. I have been taught that I'm supposed to pour out my soul to the Lord. Yet when I do pour out my soul, it fits into a very narrow and small frame, not unlike a Procrustean bed. When I pray, I am taught to say, Our Father in heaven, we thank thee, we ask thee, in the name of Jesus Christ, amen. Not much, really, of my reality fits in there. Furthermore, there are content restrictions. We do a lot of discussion among ourselves about what is good and what is not good to pray about. There are content restrictions and formal restrictions, meaning that when I pour out my soul, this very intimate part of my being, what I'm really doing is taking and locating that very intimate part of my being in this very narrow, small space provided by the community. As an anthropologist, I say that. As a believer, I don't see anything wrong with that. It works. It's great. It's been very beneficial to me and very lovely. But this notion of a restricted code doesn't only apply to testimony. It applies or to prayer. It applies to testimony. Furthermore, it applies to every one of our everyday activities. The linguist Basil Bernstein actually came up with the notion of restricted code. He was fascinated to notice that in some societies, people say lots with very few words. In other societies, people take a lot of words to say very little. Have you ever noticed that? Okay. I'm sure that you've been in... let me tell you a story. I have a friend who was once dating a Mormon woman from... she's actually from out of state, from Massachusetts. And the friend was complaining... The friend was from Salt Lake. And he was complaining to me that she just wasn't getting the hints. Wasn't catching the hints. In Salt Lake society, this notion of hints is very important. People seldom tell you things directly. Or am I wrong? I mean, is this your experience as well? People seldom tell you things directly. Like my state president hasn't told me directly what I have said wrong. Instead, they drop hints. The good, spiritual, righteous, well-constituted Mormon should be able to catch those hints. Why? Because if they are part of the same community, they know what that means. Let me give you another example. How, as Latter-day Saints, do you criticize a talk? Do you walk up to someone after sacrament meeting and say, you know, Brother Joe, you wouldn't say that, Brother Smith or whatever, you know, Brother Smith, I really didn't like your talk. I think you're doctrinally wrong. Let me tell you why. And furthermore, you know, you have a really bad oral style. You might want to work on it. You're boring, frankly. Have any of you ever said that to anybody? Someone has. Oh, well, I quit. Actually, if there's only one person, I think we just proved it. In reality, what you might do is talk to everybody else. You'd go home and talk to your spouse or to your family and go, boy, that was a horrible talk. I just don't agree with it. But to the person, you'd walk up and go, nice talk. You know, there's a code in Mormonism. We know when we've done a bad job. If someone walks up and goes, that was the most moving talk. It has really moved my life. And we're all emotional and teary. Then we know we did a good job. And if someone walks up and goes, nice talk. Bad. Okay? It was a bad talk. That is an example of a restricted code. It's an example of a kind of social criticism moving through indirect means. Now, one could argue that that is also deceitful. It's deceitful to a degree when people don't have access to the code, when they don't know the social meaning of it. There's enough ambiguity in Mormonism that many of us don't anymore know the precise meanings of those codes, of what they mean. This leads to a certain kind of conflict, and so on. Another point I want to make about restricted codes is that in restricted codes, there's a boundary between what is sayable and what isn't sayable. There are things that you can say in polite conversation, and there are things that you cannot say. You can only say by allusion. Victorian society is one of the classic things of restricted codes. Victorians could talk about most everything we can, but they would do it in a very laconic fashion by making oblique references, something that is almost very difficult to decipher unless you've had enough access to Victorian society for it to make sense, not unlike Mormon hints. Okay? So my question is, I'd really like to know what the boundaries of the sayable and the unsayable are. I gather, because I've run afoul of them, that one thing is thou shalt not talk about terrorism. Okay? I'm not sure about that one, but I know that there are many other boundaries that we face in all of our lives. I'm not going to give content to those boundaries, but I'd like you to think about them. Because whether we know it or not, those boundaries imbue our consciousness, they form our lives. They enable us to say and mobilize certain thoughts and not say and mobilize other thoughts. I want to play more with this notion of the restricted code. The temple is a model. The temple is a model of the kind of collective understanding that comes about by a restricted code. We're taught that the temple is an endowment. I'm not going to talk very much about the temple, so you don't have to get worried. The temple is an endowment. Okay, it's supposed to be an endowment of wisdom and knowledge. But one noticeable fact about the temple is that it's extremely regimented, extremely group organized, extremely uniform. Although it's supposed to be individual, there's very precious little individuality about the temple. Okay. The same thing holds in much of our Mormon life. We have a strongly restricted ritual code in our sacrament meetings. We argue that we should be able to express our heart. But as in prayer, where things are very limited and codified, We have a restricted code. In priesthood meetings, it's restricted. I was at a priesthood meeting last Sunday, a Sunday school class last Sunday in Bolivia, where the teacher was just doing horrible things with scriptures, really wrenching them. And I wanted to say, he was a bishop. Bishop, can't remember, his Blanco, I think was his last name. Bishop Blanco, I don't think you're interpreting the scriptures right. And I ran right up against a barrier in myself, because I knew that to do that would disrupt the class and make everybody feel like I had profaned the sacredness of the occasion. I had somehow, it seemed to me, run up against a transgression, possible transgression of the sacred. That frustrated me immensely. I'd run up on a boundary of the sayable and the not sayable. Well, I have 5 minutes, so I'll have to be brief. I'd run up on a boundary of the sayable and the unsayable. We cross those boundaries all of our lives. Where do those boundaries come from? In part, they come because we need to have something like language to tell us what the divine is. How do we know whether we're good Latter-day Saints? Well, we can show everybody our temple recommend here. Would you like to see it? Or we can say, we can walk around, we can, well, I'm not going to continue. We can easily use our language. People know that a person is spiritual in our community if they speak spiritually. Am I not right? People know that someone is good whether they use the right language. What is the model of the right language? Where does it come from? Who is sort of the epitome of the spiritual? And we all know people who try really hard to speak that way and just can't quite pull it off, and we kind of laugh at them at the same time. But yet, in and of itself, the spiritual is mobilized through speech, through language. This means that our community dynamics, the way we get status and maintain status within our community, depends on the way we speak. It means that we lock ourselves into a certain straitjacket of language, of lock ourselves into a jacket of not being able to see things or say things, because if we say them, we run the risk of losing our acceptability to other people as good people. This is a problem for us. To quickly move on, I think that this is also linked with hierarchy, in the sense that as a community, we take the model of good speech as something that comes from above. The model of good speech is the whispering of the Spirit to our souls. The model of the good speech is testimony. All of our comings and goings should be like a testimony, should they not? They should express the same amount of purity, directness, simplicity as a testimony. Rather hard to have an argument with somebody in that case. But it should express that directness, at least from us. By doing that, we're also accepting a certain canon, a certain structure of power. The social thinker Michel Foucault from France pointed this out very nicely. When he argued that language, discourse, structures the universe and gives power in terms of what is sayable and not sayable. We also have a structured universe that makes some things unsayable in terms of a restricted code and other things sayable. It's anchored into hierarchy and power. Okay, I'll give you an example of the way secrecy functions here. There's a manual, a priesthood manual, that very few of us have access to unless you're a priesthood leader. I think everybody ought to have access to it, but very few do. This is a control of information. It's a control of the ability to reveal. In the same Sunday school class in Bolivia, there was an argument that came up, a little argument, between some members who were less delicate than I and the bishop. And the bishop says, oh, I'm sure that there was an instruction that came out, a priesthood instruction that came out on that recently. You're wrong, and I'm going to go find it. What this is, it's a one-upmanship based on access to privileged information rather than enabling discussion and movement. It's one that builds and sustains power and difference rather than one that enables discussion and treatment of important spiritual ends. To close, I think there are some nice things and some serious drawbacks to this kind of situation. As Latter-day Saints, we have a very nicely functioning religious community on the whole. We have a very meaningful and powerful religious system that works for most people. But it also means that we have a very constrained, constricted vision of ourselves and the vision of the world because of the restrictions built into the code. It also means that when we violate those restrictions, we run the risk of violating our notion of the sacred. We run the risk of collapsing the community and even denying ourselves. I'm sure that you all have felt the tremendous chaos that one feels inside when one first has a doubt a real fundamental, serious doubt about Mormonism. One feels like the earth is falling from underneath one, or at least I felt that way. Or when one crosses the taboo and violates the canons of what one can say and cannot say, one also feels a chasm underneath one. One can tell how other Mormons react by the tightening of the eyes, the tightening of the face, the ones broken the taboo. Mormons don't tell you directly you violated taboos. You have to look for those little subtle hints. In some ways, we're a society of masks. We present masks to each other, masks of spirituality, masks of righteousness, masks of restricted language, to build status with each other. This has an importance in our religious system, to be sure. It has the drawback that it makes it very, very hard for us as an entire people to communicate honestly and openly with one another. It also means that inevitably there's a certain degree of deceit in our interactions. Maybe not conscious deceit, but deceit in the sense that we are seldom fully honest with one another. Full and open disclosure is not a common practice among most Mormons. I've been struck for a long time at how distant intimate Mormon friends are as opposed to intimate Mormon friends I've seen in other cultures. I can cite cultures that are worse than Mormons, but there's a distance among us, as if in some way we had a deep fear of each other. Fear that somehow y'all might discover that I'm really not as spiritual as I appear to be. I've just been told I need to leave it there, so I will. Thank you very much.
I had an opportunity to read Professor McDaniel's paper before making these comments, but what Professor Knowlton has had to say in the main has been, this is my first exposure to it and hearing it now, although I had seen an outline, and he certainly laid a lot on the table for us to consider, and I can't begin to comment on everything he has to say, but one dichotomy that seems to run through his entire treatment of the subject matter are these two hats that he wears, the Latter-day Saint hat and the anthropologist had, and it seems that the dichotomy there is one between intellect and heart or spirituality, and it's interesting that this dichotomy is perpetuated by Professor Knowlton. I've heard it more often in context by BYU religion professors and authorities in the church, and it's always struck me as an interesting one. It reminds me of this old story, The Wizard of Oz. You recall that the three individuals they met along the way were the Scarecrow, the Tin Woodsman, and the Cowardly Lion, and the Scarecrow wanted a brain and Tin Woodsman wanted a heart, and I think that sometimes we entertain the notion that we can either be the Scarecrow or we can be the Tin Woodsman at any point in time or in our lives, but it's impossible to be both. And I don't know that we've examined thoroughly enough the issue as to whether or not we can have both the heart and the intellect and they operate at the same time. My suspicion is these are just abstractions and we're putting labels on things that we really couldn't in any objective way distinguish one between the other, and I'm not entirely sure that Professor Knowlton has to change hats with the frequency that he does in his paper. Now let me go to my prepared comments. Both of the professors have provided us with some interesting observations regarding timely and apparently controversial topics. It wouldn't be a good expenditure of my time or yours if I simply recounted the points on which I agree or the points on which I may differ. I'll defer to Professor Knowlton's desire that we be a little less concerned about consensus and just getting along, and of course my instinctual contrariness as a litigator, and I'll argue for a bit different approach to the concerns dealt with in these papers. Following Professor Knowlton's lead, I advance my observations under three headings: confidentiality in place of the word secret, intimacy in place of the word sacred, and misunderstanding in place of the word deceit. First, confidentiality. Secret is such a nice, simple word. We spit it out, and it quickly covers a lot of territory, simultaneously tantalizing us with things untold, offending us with things that haven't been disclosed to us, and empowering those who know something that someone else doesn't know. But the word really tells us nothing about why the thing to which it is attached is not disclosed. In this regard, I would prefer the word confidential. This word has considerable meaning to me as an attorney. In my capacity as a counselor at law, I am bound by a code of ethics not to disclose those things revealed to me by my clients. My refusal to do so arises not because most of what I have been told is particularly interesting or scandalous, or by reason of a desire to exert power over others or to be in on something. I keep confidences because I have undertaken a duty to do so. Were my clients not sure of my absolute commitment to adhere to this duty, they would no doubt be disinclined to confide in me the information vital to an adequate representation of their interests. Even when these clients fire me or I lose interest in their affairs, I remain under obligation to keep their communications to me in confidence. A newspaper reporter undertakes a similar duty when he or she obtains information from a source on the representation that the identity of the source will not be disclosed. And to keep this promise, we have recently seen high-minded individuals submit even to incarceration rather than disclose the source. This form of confidence-keeping may also be seen in the footnotes to Professor McDaniel's 1991 paper, in which she declines to provide names and limits her identification of the individuals providing her with information to initials, age, and church activity. Of course, such examples of confidentiality have their analog in the church context. Ecclesiastical leaders receive information from those with whom they counsel with a clear, legally protected understanding that matters discussed will not be made public. Similarly, individuals participate in church meetings where personal problems are discussed with a shared expectation that the information and views exchanged will not be made available to the general church membership. And this brings us to the temple. There is information to be gained through attendance in the temple, but it is available only upon a solemn representation that it will be maintained in confidence and not disclosed to others outside the temple. If one declines to undertake this obligation of confidentiality, one will not be permitted to receive the information. Implicit in this obligation of confidentiality is a certain circumspection with respect to discussion of the unique clothing associated with the temple. Professor McDaniel suggests that church leaders in some manner directed their comments on symposia at her and in the process attempted to restrict her ability to examine aspects of the LDS religion. As I reread the First Presidency Quorum of the Twelve statement, I'm not persuaded that Professor McDaniel is the ultimate focus of the author's concern. She has made no promises of confidentiality in an ecclesiastical context, either implicit or explicit, in order to obtain the information used in her paper. And to the extent she has made any promises of confidentiality in preparing the paper, she has most admirably kept those promises. I believe the statement regarding symposia reflects concern not with Professor McDaniel herself, but with the persons who provided her with a forum for discussion. Many of those people obtained the information to which she alludes in her paper through promises of confidentiality. While those persons may not have presented their own papers based upon the confidential information obtained through the making of promises, one could argue that they have done the functional equivalent by providing a forum for someone to make unattributed disclosure of that same information. And Professor McDaniel's only conceivable indiscretion in this regard would be in making herself a party to such disclosure in violation of the original promises made by her interviewees. Therefore, on the topic of confidentiality, I believe that we would have seen no First Presidency statement had Professor McDaniel presented the same paper at the YMCA, the Greek Orthodox Church, the Garden Club, or the public library. As it is, she is the victim of the crossfire of conflicting views regarding what topics are appropriate for discussion among covenant-bound Latter-day Saints. My next topic is intimacy. The word sacred is, in modern society, a bit of an anachronism. While many may know the definition of the word, it seems anymore that only a relative few have any working concept of the word. That is, only a few actually hold anything to be sacred. And by way of footnote, Professor McDaniel, and to a lesser extent Professor Knowlton, at least when he's wearing his anthropologist hat, seem to have a rather two-dimensional view of the word sacred. They can measure its height and breadth, but they are at a loss to mark its depth, perhaps because they have nothing in their lives that they experience as sacred. Thus, they may be inclined to discount the reality of sacred experience as something so subjective that it is not worthy of serious regard. To approximate a portion of the meaning of sacred, at least in a more secular sense, I propose instead the word intimate. This word covers a variety of impulses that move us to shield information. As an example, for the last 20 years, we as a country have engaged in a national debate over the scope of female privacy rights centered on where a woman's personal intimacy begins and public interest begins. Something may be intimate because of its spiritual significance or because of its perceived personal nature or simply because of some undefined reticence we feel about disclosing it except in the most private, reassuring of settings. Intimacy is nearly always a subjective manner. What is intimate to you may well be inconsequential to me, but that divergence does not entitle me to disregard your perspective, whether in the name of academic inquiry or merely in the name of curiosity. It was another generation of scholars who, in their arrogance, excavated kivas with backhoes and stocked museums with burial clothes, holy relics, and ancient cultures, holy relics of ancient cultures, and other curiosities. In this regard, a very helpful recent article that sort of brings this out is in the March 1992 Smithsonian, in which they discuss the recent explorations at the Casa Malpais down in Springerville, Arizona, which is a Mogollon Indian ruin. And it talks about how the people who initially found it, who were just ranchers and farmers, looted the place of all the bones in the burial spot and sold them to an Indian fellow who ground them down into dust in order to use that. And he was a shaman, and he was using it in some fashion for magical spells. And it struck me as rather interesting in terms of the treatment of the, quote, sacred items that were found in those burial grounds. Now, of course, those who are excavating that particular place have Zuni and Hopi consultants who actually are with them in the locations and determine where they go and where they do not go. Returning to the paper, this refusal to attach meaningful value to the views of others is the source of so much conflict in the world today. And peace and civilization mandate a significant regard for others' rights of intimacy. The subject matter of Professor McDaniel's paper touches intimacy concerns in two regards, and this was referring to the 1991 paper now. Most obvious is that emphasized in the First Presidency Statement under the heading of sacred. The statement points out quite validly that information regarding the temple is held in a special status by many, if not most, who have participated in temple ordinances. This fact alone, as suggested by my previous observation, mandates some caution. Granted that what is sacred or intimate is subjective, it is still a perilous thing to disregard the perspective of others. As an example, suppose I were to place in the same room a hyperactive six-year-old, a set of magic markers, a knife, a box of matches, and a painting by Van Gogh, such as Starry Night or Sunflowers. A chemical or objective analysis would reveal that the Van Gogh consists of little more than canvas framing material and assorted oil-based pigments. We might, with detachment, describe the feelings of those who view the Van Gogh as an object of artistic significance. Likely, it would not be an object of significance to the six-year-old. Yet to most of us, this scenario is horrifying, and we would do all within our power to prevent the child's disregard for or failure to comprehend the significance of the art that might result in a harm or harm to the painting. Likewise, each of us has his or her Van Gogh, her or his intimate apparel. This awareness is what I would call the third dimension, the depth to which I previously alluded. And one might respond that, well, a priceless work of art is a far cry from a common pair of undershorts. And this might be true in the eyes of many in today's society, but I'm confident that I would not have to walk far out of this room to find someone who has no more regard for the Van Gogh than they have for my T-shirt. It seems that if I am to ask others to respect that which I choose to value, I must do them the courtesy of having some regard for that which they elect to value. Certainly, it is not prima facie evidence of overreaching for church members, whether or not leaders, to point out instances in which they believe that things held sacred by them and those who believe like them are in some way profaned. And this brings us to a second, less objective point, but worth mentioning. Discussion of temple-related vestments is not the same as talking about a pair of socks, a top hat, or a winter coat. The clothing discussed by Professor McDaniel is objectively intimate without regard to the temple or the subjective feelings of any particular Latter-day Saint. The average person is reticent to talk about his or her underwear, whether it was first obtained at the temple, at Victoria's Secret, or at J.C. It is not surprising that persons were reluctant to have their names associated with comments made to Professor McDaniel, or that others similarly situated find that the very discussion of such articles of clothing a distressing manner. Notwithstanding the temptation to delve into these fascinating topics that are admittedly rarely discussed except in the most offhand way, I think it is essential at least to acknowledge a legitimacy in the perspective of those who question the propriety of such discussion. My final heading was misunderstanding. Considerations of confidentiality and intimacy shield significant amounts of information within the LDS Church from at-large discussion. I must differ with Professor Knowlton to the extent that he views these shields or their motive as a byproduct of some desire or form of deceit. The very word deceit suggests a conscious intent to present things other than as they are. Rather, I believe the problem is one of misunderstanding. The overuse of the word sacred and the concept behind it within the LDS Church has resulted in the erection of boundaries of confidentiality and intimacy well beyond a justifiable territory to areas where such boundaries or barriers are unwarranted. When something is labeled sacred, our capacity to discuss it, the language we use, and the context in which we can speak necessarily becomes limited. As these boundaries expand through what I will call over-sacralization, our discourse contracts. I recall the consequences of over-sacralization on my mission in Mexico. With everything made holy in the mission field, as it is, many missionaries become incapable of distinguishing truly holy things from matters of little spiritual consequence. They lack the sense of priority regarding the circumstances confronting them daily. This resulted in a rather crude and profane attitude among many missionaries. The use of slang to refer to sacred things, the telling of rather bizarre stories, such as some of those that Professor McDaniel cites, the transformation of highly questionable ideas into spiritual verities, and the desacralization of the gospel message into a sing-song delivery of a sales pitch. This devaluation occurs when we fail to have some sense of hierarchy regarding those things of great spiritual significance, those things of limited spiritual significance, and those of no immediate spiritual significance. A broad definition of sacred that encompasses not only eternal principles and doctrines, but also folk notions, the acts and utterances of weak mortals, and in sum, everything associated with the church can lead us to be undiscerning in a rather hazardous way. LDS scriptures bring home again and again the fundamental principle that no thing in this mortal sphere, including human beings, is perfect. The Book of Mormon term for this is the arm of the flesh. Nevertheless, in the urge to avoid what is widely called contention and to give due regard to all purporting to be sacred, we often take an easy path and abandon the admittedly positive virtue or gift of discernment. The result is a culture that, in a rush to give no offense, is all too often prepared to buy whatever spiritual snake oil is for sale without the slightest inquiry as to its source or contents. In the end, a non-prioritized concept of the sacred constricts the flow of information and the rhetoric with which we clothe our spiritual impulses to the point that a communication and information vacuum develops. We struggle to find meaning and practical direction in nondescript or ambiguous official communications, and ultimately conclude that much of that does not coincide with our experience in the world at large, nor is it sufficiently frank or informative to guide us in that troubled world. To fill the vacuum, we form a circle of trusted associates with whom we can speak candidly on these sacred topics, and eventually symposia such as this emerge. So in the end, the very mindset, evidenced by the statement issued last year, produces rather than deters the gathering in which we are participating today. And if there are those who have absented themselves from this proceeding by reason of that statement, we may rest assured that they will inevitably find another outlet for their ideas and alternative sources of information. Thank you.
We have a few minutes now for questions from the audience. If you have a question, please stand and speak loudly, and we'll ask the respondents to repeat the question or give their sense of it as they respond. Please do tell us who you would like the question directed to.
The question is, when I use the terms semiotic downward mobility, a rather arcane term, hey, I can remember it. I spend all night thinking of these word terms. When I use the term semiotic mobility, the question is, why can't we just leave the spirit up there in the heavens where it belongs and just tap into it instead of trying to bring it into downward mobility? The problem, again, although I hate to fall into dichotomies, I have to agree with Mr. Olson, that use of Mr. Olson sounds weird, with Eric, that dichotomies often misconstrue, and they are abstractions, but you know they're useful abstractions and necessary abstractions for helping us to measure reality. Abstractions seldom have verifiable empirical reference, and we could go into a long epistemological argument about that, but I won't bother. What I'm saying is that I have to have this dichotomy between being an anthropologist some ways and a Latter-day Saint in order to even begin to answer your question. As a Latter-day Saint, I know what the sacred is. I know what the spirit is. I love to hear the whisperings of the Lord. However, as an anthropologist, I don't know what that is. Because I see it in our society one way. I go to another society and I see it totally differently. I go to another society and darned if they don't do something radically different than we do, and yet they all make reference to the same thing, namely the spirit, or to God, or the divine, or sacred. Basically the same thing. So as a scientist, I have to ask myself, why is it that different societies do different things and have different concepts, different understandings about what is fundamentally the same thing? And the answer then is that I have to depend on a concept like semiotic downward mobility to see how people appropriate and make use of the sacred for their social benefit. In other words, I have to see the social function of it. As a believer, I'm delighted to leave it in its heavens. As a scholar, I would say, then I would never understand it if I only left it in its heavens. I need to do both. I'd also like, while I've got the microphone, to respond to Eric a little bit. I really appreciate his comments. I thought they were very nice. It's good to hear a contrary voice. Actually, in some ways, argument is the best form of flattery. I'd like to ask Eric, though, a question, if I could. In contract law, it's my understanding that one cannot, after the contract has been signed, expand the form of the contract. Am I wrong? Without agreement and compliance by both sides. Eric nods in affirmation. When I went through the temple, I swore secrecy to the rites and vows. I did not swear that I would not talk about the entire temple ceremony, nor that I would never mention the name temple. That expansion has been recent, since I first went through the temple. And I'm not that old. Since I first went through the temple, I remember very clearly what I made a vow to. So there's no contractual violation from my point of view, no covenantal violation to talk about the temple. What there is a violation of possibly is a violation of the power of the general authorities to expand things and to define their things, our obligations as members of the church. But that isn't covenant law per se, if you could talk about it as law. It's a change, and I think it's wise to look at it that way. One other point, or a couple of more points. Eric is wise to point out some of the problems. Social science usually seems to lack a comprehension of the depth of spirituality. Let me guarantee you that often among the social scientists who deal with religion, you find a greatest appreciation for the depth of spirituality, for the depth of religious longing. All they want to do is understand it and comprehend it in another way. But like profaning, understanding a phenomenon is often the destruction of the very same phenomenon. It has to be reconfigured. And Eric is right when he talks about the dangers of duality. As individuals, we need to reconfigure what we split asunder into our lives to make them whole again. I think that Eric makes a mistake when he talks about intimacy and the sacred as something individual. He's falling into a classical error of American society, namely seeing everything as an individual reference point. In reality, the individual is, by and large, contingent. It's dependent on social reality. The individual, in social thought at least, is a tabula rasa. It's an empty vessel when it comes in the world. To have individual, it has to be codified by society. If we were to talk about individual, simply individual sacredness, we would have nothing. The forms of sacred are the ways by which our biological beings come into contact with cultural forms. It makes no sense to talk about spirituality or sacredness as simply being subjective. That's how we feel it to a degree because of our society that says that individuals have ontological priority. Sorry for the big words. That is not an ontological verity in and of itself. Okay? I'll let someone else talk and ask questions now. Yeah.
There's a difference between being tall and being short. Just a couple of questions. First, I'll repeat what I understood was the sense. And if I understand you correctly, you were saying that you're a convert from Catholicism, and that one of the things about the LDS tradition, which you appreciate, is that it doesn't worship crucifixes or have other kinds of material objects which are sacred. And the question is, why are you treating garments like this? Garments just are reminders of covenant. First of all, no Catholic would ever tell you that the crucifix which they have in their home is Jesus on a cross. Catholics, like all other religious groups, use crucifixes or rosaries or pictures to help them create a spiritual attitude and to approach the divine. These are what we call spiritual helps. And almost every religious group, from the Quakers with their silence, which in some ways is an icon, to Catholics who have a more developed sacramental system, have things which help them reach the divine. And this is, I think, what David was getting at, that all religious groups have human aspects to their theology or their art which help them reach the sacred. And my approach or my analysis, which we didn't talk about today but which we did last time, of garments is not that this is somehow some kind of magical piece of cloth. To the contrary, what I discussed was its relationship to people's spiritual lives. So I wouldn't want to talk about, I wouldn't want you to think that my interest in garments is in some ways turning them into magical objects, because I don't see that. And my analysis was based on what people told me about how they felt and their spiritual life was enriched or so on because of that use. So don't think that crucifixes for Catholics are Jesus on the cross, just like that's not the case for garments as well. Is that where you're... Okay, excellent. Very interesting point. So I missed the strand of his comments, which were addressed more about the people who were upset about talking about this, because they in themselves have, Eric left, but have over-sacralized this particular part of their religious life. So that's an interesting point.
Well, I appreciate the vote of confidence. That's very nice of you. I'm not really sure there's much I can say other than to say that I don't understand either, and it really is very baffling. In Colleen's case, or Colleen, she corrected me not to use the Utah pronunciation. In Colleen's case, I think the situation is somewhat different. Colleen is an outsider to the community, and when outsiders come into the community and understand things, they see things in ways that are often uncomfortable to us, because they're going to see things in ways that we don't see them. And that's inherently going to make us uncomfortable. We all talk about our garments. The benefit of Colleen's presentation is that everybody wanted to talk to her. And when they started talking, they went on and on and on. Am I not right? They really went on, meaning that they wanted to talk. And come on, every one of you have heard garment stories from the pulpit. I mean, about the missionary who was riding a surfboard and the shark came along and bit his leg off, except for it left didn't get him where the garments were. We talk like that. We do. We make the garments magical and ritual. The problem here is one of boundaries and levels. When we talk among ourselves in privacy, it's okay, because we all know we're believing Latter-day Saints, and there's no problem. But boy, howdy, let an outsider get a hold, and let them publish what is private, in other words, what's intimate among the groups, then suddenly we start perceiving a problem. Or let them take the folklore and make it public, and then there's a problem. I disagree with Eric's use of over-sacralization. He's talking about the difference between a folk religion, what the people believe, what's meaningful to them, and an elite formal religion. To the elite...